Okay, Minister, thank you very much for coming in. Now, earlier this week, we saw the Communications Committee grilling RTE Director General and Chairman over the Reynolds report. Now, very valid points being made, of course, but it seemed to me watching that there were some politicians with axes to grind against the media. Are politicians the best ones to be holding the media to account?
Well, I mean, I don't think that you can argue that politicians ought not discharge their functions on behalf of society. I mean, if you look across the water at what's happening in the House of Commons, I think it's done the job immensely well. Yes, indeed, of course there are politicians who have axes to grind. Some people think there are even political parties who have axes to grind. And generally speaking, that's a healthy tension. I wouldn't worry about it. There are also politicians who like grandstanding and play acting, and I saw a certain amount of that in the couple of minutes snippet that I saw yesterday. But I think the notion of state companies being required to account for their stewardship before a parliamentary committee is a correct concept. And of course, RTE is a state company with a difference because of the significance of media in Irish life.
That's exactly the point, though, isn't it? It is not just any state company. It's the one that has held politics to account.
It is certainly not a typical run-of-the-mill state company, nor to be compared to the typical commercial state enterprise. That is not to say that elected members of Parliament ought not be able to put the questions that the public want put, and that the public can see that for themselves and make their own judgment about where the line is crossed and so on. It's the job of a board that is put in place to run RTE to be sufficiently robust to take that.
I saw Eamon O'Queeve earlier in the week saying that the Reynolds case shouldn't be allowed to rest yet. Do you think it's time to draw a line under it?
I do, yes. The matter has been subjected to a great deal of scrutiny, not just formally in terms of the BAI report and John Horgan's report and so on, but also in the media. It has been analysed in some forensic detail and also occasionally, not without malice entirely, by others who enjoy the discomfiture of RTE in this particular case. But that's the nature of the business. I'm no expert in the area, but I don't think that it's possible to easily improve on the recommendations that have been brought forward. And RTE has committed to implementing the recommendations. The debate will continue. But the business of seeking to go back over the past and arbitrarily inquire into, I mean, would be ridiculous for a whole variety of reasons. And there, I think, the motivation of politicians advocating that course is merely to say, you're down and by Jesus, we'll kick you now.
Now, you met the RTE board recently and you gave them, I'd say, a qualified vote of confidence in that nobody was sacked and nobody was resigned. Now, this week we heard Sean Gallagher come out and say that when he went with his complaint about Tweetgate, that he was met with arrogance, that he was met dismissively, he was met with defensiveness, much as Father Reynolds apparently was when he first complained. Are you satisfied that the culture can change quickly enough?
No, I'm not satisfied that it can change quickly. The proof of the pudding will be in the eating there, you know. An organisation in Irish terms as large as RTE, comprising the diversity of people that it does and that are attracted to work in the media and so on, and people of creative instincts, people of strong views, people of strong opinions, and the fact that it has had some considerable dominance in Irish life means that it does have a culture. I don't agree with some of the things that Sean Gallagher said, but I wouldn't be dismissive of the point that he makes that there can be an arrogance in the response. I think that Father Kevin Rills experienced that at the hard edge as well.
Your own involvement in this has been criticised by Vincent Brown, among others, who said that you usurped the BAI's authority and that you overstepped your own role. To what extent is there some truth in that? Is it the role of a politician to be holding the broadcaster to account? Do you not need a beefed up, fully independent authority with genuine teeth?
Unless you can point me in the direction, I'm not sure of where I was criticised other than by Vincent Brown. And I thought that I could have done a better job in criticising my involvement myself than Vincent did in the particular piece that he wrote in the Irish Times.
But what I'm saying is, should it have been up to you to call on the authority to investigate this? Is that not what an authority is there for?
Well, I think maybe you can argue that, but a certain amount of time had elapsed and nothing was happening. It seemed to me that remarks on behalf of RTE to the effect that old heads don't learn any lessons and so on warranted a response. And for that reason, I intervened, and my government colleagues agreed with me. The investigation was passed to the body that's charged with doing that. I mean, it may be that there is an argument when all of this settles down to have a look at whether the legislation requires finessing in the light of this experience. It has never been invoked before. And, you know, things like cut-off points about unless you make a complaint to the broadcaster within 30 days that the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland is helpless and so on. You know, we may need to look at whether some minor refurbishment of the law is necessary. But I don't think that as communications minister with responsibility for broadcasting that I should drive around completely ignorant of what's going on around me.
Now, considering that most material now ends up online sooner or later, broadcast and print, is there an argument for a sort of combined media authority like they've got in Australia that oversees all content?
Perhaps there is, but I don't know enough about it, to be honest, to have formed a view on it yet. Clearly, the whole convergence of technology and indeed behavioural patterns have changed dramatically, and the old vertically integrated model of broadcasting, or media indeed as we know it, has changed, not just is changing, but has changed. And in those circumstances, there may indeed be a necessity for such an integrated approach. I suspect it's quite complex, though, in terms of any citizen now who has a smartphone and a connection to the internet might call themselves a journalist. I think it poses serious questions in terms of regulation. I think most people have been surprised that the Press Council, for all of the criticism at the time it was established, has functioned fairly well. Maybe you will say, well, it's too early to say and they haven't had a serious challenge yet or a challenging issue yet. I think as a model, it has worked reasonably well. Whether the day will come when you can see some similar self-regulation of the totality of media is an interesting question, but not one that I consider myself sufficiently informed on.
Before we draw a final line under the Reynolds case, can you give me any idea what you reckon the total cost will be? I mean, this is clearly of relevance. If it were shareholders in a private company, they'd be looking for heads to roll and they'd want to know the final cost. I mean, I know that the legal costs have been cut by the taxing master this week, but it was very expensive blunder.
It was a very expensive blunder, but I mean, how do you put a price on the egregious error that was made? I mean, nobody is disputing that. I don't think we know the cost yet, and the parliamentary committee will probably elicit that before it is finished. Of course it's costly, but it's even more costly in terms of the damage that has been done and the huge challenge that there is now for RTE to restore the position of trust that it undoubtedly has enjoyed in Irish life since its inception. I'd like to think that that track record has to count for something. Let's hope that enforcement of the protocols and procedures now in place will ensure, insofar as it's humanly possible, that something like this does never happen again.
No heads have actually rolled, though, as far as we're aware. There was one person left on early retirement, another took voluntary redundancy. Would that be tolerated in a private company? And does that answer concerns about accountability?
I think it's a significant sanction that the team concerned for Primetime Investigates has been disbanded and that the programme has been terminated, whilst at the same time the board giving a commitment that investigative journalism, there will be a productive strand of investigative journalism in the station and that that can be evaluated by any observer. But the team has been disbanded. I mean, some would say that they have paid a heavy price. There is a procedure still ongoing in RTE, chaired by the former Senator Maurice Hayes, and that hasn't concluded its business. My understanding is that it will within the next couple of weeks. You know, I see the front page of one of the papers saying that Mattie McGrath, the ubiquitous Mattie McGrath, has called for the sacking of the chairman, and someone else has suggested sacking the board. The board is not responsible for micromanaging editorial matter and programme output. The board is responsible for putting in place procedures that, if observed, wouldn't have permitted this to happen. In this case, the procedures there were not observed. They were not complied with. People have different opinions on this. Some people would say that the board should ultimately take the responsibility for that. I have to have regard to the fact that the changing climate that we have briefly touched on is impacting very seriously in RTE. RTE will have a bottom line this year of some 50 million. That's an awesome figure. Okay, it comprises a very significant cost of once-off of the restructuring that has gone on. But the fact of the matter is that can't be sustained and is not sustainable, nor is it permissible vis-a-vis the independent sector that operates in the broadcasting landscape today. So we've got to get that into hand. So, I mean, you know, do you pull down the House of Cards because a dreadful error that everybody admits oughtn't to have happened, happened? And do you pull down the House of Cards as a result of that? I think it's very important that there is an assertive public service broadcaster in Ireland. If we do damage to that, we will live to regret it in other aspects of life.
Now, you mentioned earlier a necessary tension between politics and the media. I mean, you know yourself, one of your predecessors in communications, Ray Bourke, was very keen to hang on to that brief through several changes of portfolio. And the conclusion would appear to be that it's a nice way to control the media, and if there's things you want to hide, it's a good place to be. Now, you yourself recently referred to some political coverage as tittle-tattle. Do you see why there may be some scepticism from the public about politicians criticising the nature of political coverage in this country?
Well, of course, that depends on whether you disagree with me, that a lot of it is tittle-tattle.
What do you mean by tittle-tattle, though? Can you give me an example of tittle-tattle?
Well, I mean, firstly, what I said and what wasn't reported was that in some sections of the print media, now I don't know why journalists choose to leave out that phrase, I made a speech on World Press Freedom Day about the merits of a free press and went out of my way to pay tribute to journalists, instancing in particular their contribution to the Arab Spring and indeed to the role in respect of politics and corruption in our society, and so on, and instance the name of my own colleague and your former colleague, Susan O'Keefe. But I went on to say that in some sections of the print media, that this was not to gloss over the fact that some of the coverage of politics is tittle-tattle. And by that I mean trivial, superficial, not focusing on the substantive or the analytical. And it had incidentally had nothing, as it happens, to do with broadcasting at all. But I always find it amusing that journalists who are so liberal in ladling it out to politicians are such fragile flowers when you raise an eyebrow and they all rush to make little jibes and comments over the weekend. I find that amusing. I remember a discussion that I had when I was Commerce Minister in either 1995 or 1996 when I met members of the board and the senior management of the Independent News and Media Group. And John Maher, the then deputy chairman, said to me, the thing you have to understand, Minister, we're not operating in an Irish market. This is a regional market. And that inevitably down the road is going to lead to some dumbing down. It's always stuck with me. And of course, it's in the eye of the beholder whether you believe he was right or not.
I suppose one person's dumbing down, though, is another person's populist, readable material.
It is. You're quite right about that, Brenda, but I'm entitled to have an opinion about what's rubbish and what's worth reading.
Now, you mentioned there that you addressed the subject of a free press, that conference last week. Obviously, the two threats to a free press in a democracy are big business and political interference. Are you concerned about concentration of media ownership, cross-media ownership?
Oh, I am, and one has to be. Anybody that acknowledges that media plays a hugely important role in forming the character of our society and the nature of public discourse in our society has to be concerned about plurality, by which I mean diversity of content and diversity of ownership. It's not like you apply the competition principles to other enterprises. The media is different for that reason. We have to be vigilant about undue concentration of ownership.
So Dennis O'Brien has 29% of INM and he has 20% of the radio market, including two national stations. Is there anything you can do about that?
If there was a move by any individual or undertaking to take ownership of, say, independent news and media while having those other interests in the media, including in the broadcasting side, that would fall now to be considered in the first instance by the competition authority. The legislation that is being drafted will put a great deal more emphasis on the public interest dimension of that as well as competition precepts. And it is based to a very considerable extent, or taking into account to a very considerable extent, the Schreinen principles. This was a group established in 2008 to have a look at diversity in the media and so on and so forth. And they published what I think is a very good report. And it will enshrine that in the new law that will deal with, I don't want to get into the business of personalities, and given what happened, Vince Cable across the water, I don't want to come to it with preconceived notions. But, yes, I would be, and the government would be, concerned about undue concentration of ownership, because it doesn't matter who the individual is or what the undertaking is, that really is not acceptable because of the role of media in society.
Can I come on to the question of funding the media? I know your proposed broadcasting charge is this year. Is it due to come in?
Oh, no, it won't make it this year. It's a bit more. My preoccupation this year is with digital switchover. I certainly don't want to confuse the issues. The notion of the household broadcasting, public service broadcasting charge is that in due course it will replace the television licence. I think it's very important to hard-pressed listeners out there that I don't leave the impression that I'm bringing in a new public service broadcasting charge. It's a replacement for the TV license. And the idea is that given convergence of technologies, there are a significant amount of people accessing content on platforms other than the traditional television in the corner of the living room. Secondly, there is significant evasion of the TV license. It could be up to 30 million per annum, and that's pretty serious. There are four other states in the process of making the transition at the moment, and I hope that we won't have to reinvent the wheel, that we will learn lessons from them. But the idea is then that if you want to access public service, you have to pay. I mean, I'm fascinated by the letters of complaint I get about the TV license. They really are from a fairly eclectic range of opinion in Irish life. But I never get any complaint about Sky Sports or pay television. And remember, some of those pummel broadcasting at Irish consumers without much of a presence here are making much of a contribution here.
But we spoke to David McRedmond of TV3 here on the programme recently, and he's calling on you to make a decision on the whole issue of funding. Particularly, his argument is that RTE should be funded entirely by the licence fee, and the rest of the revenue from advertising then go to the fully commercial stations like his own. Do you see any merit in that argument?
I think it depends on your view about quality public service broadcasting, and that's leaving aside the question whether RTE always reaches the level of quality that you would like. But a quality public service broadcaster, I think, is very important in the life and culture of this country. And there is, in my own view, an irreducible minimum that if you compare to our neighbour, the BBC's, the RTE budget is minuscule. Now, you can certainly reduce it further, but if you do, the expectation that you will get quality public service content and output, I think it won't happen. And I don't want to see the destruction of that. As I say, we haven't got to the stage of making the transition yet. The focus at the moment is on digital switchover and the difficulties that will cause if it's not done properly for many viewers, especially in the more difficult topographical areas of the country or where the topography is difficult. I know David Redman's argument, and I've had a number of meetings with him, and we've been involved in terms of issues that I think have been helpful to him and so on. But I don't think the destruction of the National Public Service broadcaster is a legacy that I would want to leave behind me.
You mentioned the Leveson inquiry earlier, and some quite striking revelations coming out there about media ethics and also about the link between politics and the media. Would you be concerned that any of those same practices, for instance, the phone
Well, I don't think there's any tittle-tattle in Ireland amongst the media in Ireland, Brenda. That's a British phenomenon.
No, but would you be concerned about the practices that have emerged in Leveson that they might be replicated here?
I hope that isn't the case. But we've said that in Ireland about so many things in the past, and you find out that you were wrong and that it does happen here. It's pretty horrific what Levinson is unearthing. Pretty horrific. I don't think we have had prime ministers or senior politicians in the slavering huck to media moguls that we are seeing being excavated at Levinson. I don't think that has happened here. But it is a fiercely competitive environment at the moment. And as you have just said earlier, tittle-tattle does sell newspapers. I would have thought that if there was an element of that going on in Ireland, I would have thought that you would need to be insane as well as being criminal to continue it after Levinson.
So you think this is something that would just sort itself out if it did exist?
I don't think it will sort itself out, but I mean, I think that you will see changes in Britain as a result of Levinson and so on. I would have thought that if there is anybody in the Irish media, and I wouldn't like to think that there is, who have been engaged in similar practices to the Murdoch Empire, that they will put their house in order, because what happened in Levinson can happen here if there is evidence that that kind of conduct, which is criminal essentially, is going on here.
Yes, I mean, would you have characterised, for instance, a story like the Healy Ray phone call story or the Tonergate story? Would you characterise those as tittle-tattle?
No, I wouldn't. But I wouldn't substitute them for analytical, substantial reportage and analysis of public issues and politics. Of course there's a place for that, and both of those, I think, are worthy of reportage because there's an element of public funds involved in the abuse of the systems made available to members of the Dáil. So no, I wouldn't regard that. But to be serious about this for a moment, the committee system in the Dáil does an amount of immensely penetrative and interesting work on different matters of public interest and of policy formation interest and of governance pretty much every week. Now, it's not possible for the media. The media is not resourced, and certainly not in the present environment, to cover all of that or whatever. But it is not the stuff, in any event, that gets much of an outing or an adequate outing. And I mean, that is one of the worries about the difficult economic environment we're in, about the fact that we're losing advertising revenue, not just due to the recession, but because it's migrating to new media, that the resources aren't there to do this kind of heavy lifting. I'm as amused by tittle-tattle as anybody else, but I don't want to see it to the exclusion of serious analysis of the issues that matter in Irish public life.